We're on a mission to help founders hit product market fit faster. We do this by interviewing founders that have been there. I'm your host, Adam O'Donnell. This podcast is put together by Zendesk for Startups. We offer 6 months free of Zendesk customer support suite for qualified product-oriented companies.
Egrin, welcome to Sit Down Startup Founder Podcast. Excited to have you unpack your product market fit journey, which I know it's a constant thing, a moving target as well. But before we get into your incredible success, could you highlight kind of where you are in terms of how much money you raised, maybe some of the investors, how big your company is, and then we'll understand your personal story first.
Awesome. Adam, thank you so much for having me. Excited for this. Where are we at? We have raised almost $100 million. We're post Series C. We have raised money from some of the top VCs out there, from Index, the last round, Menlo, Headline, and some other amazing VCs that have supported us all throughout the way.
Mm, that is amazing. Well, tell me, like, let's go all the way back to when you were a kid. Where were you born? Where were you raised as a kid? And then when did you first get the idea of wanting to be a founder?
Great question. I grew up in Armenia, which is a tiny country in Eastern Europe. And actually, when I was born, Armenia didn't even exist. It was part of what was then Soviet Union. So technically, I was born in Soviet Union. And then when I was very little, the country ceased to exist, which is always a fun thing to go through as a kid. But when you're a kid, you don't quite kind of appreciate the significance of that. You're just like, well, I guess this is typically what happens. And what happened, it was kind of chaos all over the place, right? You had like a newly formed country that didn't know how to be a country. You had people worry about 9%, 8% inflation. You had like 100% inflation because they printed money that they didn't know how to, you know, price yet. And it's always fascinating when you have to deal with those kinds of things. So I grew up in Armenia, and my parents always had this kind of focus on education, that education is the future. And no matter what's going on around you, whether it's war or chaos, you have to like do well in school. But I wasn't really good at traditional school, which was one of the first leading things that led to the company eventually, which we'll get to later. But I wasn't good at traditional school, and I didn't necessarily do well up until middle school. If anything, I was branded as a troublemaker by most of the teachers in school because I'm fairly extroverted and quite disagreeable in my personality, and kids like that just tend to get into trouble more versus doing their homework and paying attention. So fortunately for me, though, I discovered math competitions around middle school, and math competitions somehow clicked for me because it was more fun, more competitive. It was more about, you know, what you could do versus following rules. And by the time I was 15, I had won every regional, national, and international math competition there was, and got accepted to MIT, moved to the US with a backpack, and the rest is history. But the way this leads to the founding of the company is when I graduated from MIT, I went to work at Google. And at Google, I started doing a lot of technical interviews because my team, just like most other teams at Google, were trying to hire a lot. But, you know, we just couldn't find great people fast enough. And this is where I started to reflect on my own journey and realized that, look, first of all, talent is the most precious resource humanity has because everything gets built, gets created by skilled and talented humans. And I, by everything, I mean literally everything, right? Like, look at the mic in front of you, the headphones, the chair, the electricity. Every single piece of that technology and advancement was made by a skilled human or by a group of skilled humans. So fixing this shortage of skills is going to be one of the most important challenges of our civilization. Now, when you look at how we approach it thus far, you realize that, well, look, most people never get the chance to live up to their potential and do what they were born to be able to do. And I got lucky at a young age to find a way of learning that spoke to me, but most people I knew never did. And then they got stuck behind the way they were supposed to learn, and they just fell off this very narrow funnel. And then lastly, even those who do get far enough to build the skills that are necessary, unless it's reflected in a resume and a pedigree, you still find it really, really difficult to get in front of the right people. So I knew a lot of people who grew up with me, went to those competitions, but they didn't happen to go to MIT because they didn't end up even applying. Maybe they stayed local, maybe they didn't even hear about it. So they couldn't even get an interview, even though they were highly skilled. And the combination of these problems, I called the talent problem, and basically quit Google to say, you know what, I'm just going to go solve this, you know, because I think there's nothing more important that I could ever be doing.
I appreciate you bringing along on that story. And I love the personal passion around it. And it just, like, it makes sense fundamentally. Help me with that decision to quit Google. Did you want to get to a certain amount of money in your personal bank account? Did you raise money before? How much of the product did you work on before you made that decision?
Definitely didn't raise money before quitting. If anything, it was, I'm just going to go do this. And you know, what happens is, especially with first-time founders, right? I have so much empathy for first-time founders. You cannot be a first-time founder without being quite irrational and without being very self-assured and believing that you can do something that in factual terms, the probability of you doing it is like pretty much zero, right? So in order for you to take that risk and to make that move, you have to have this irrational confidence and belief in something that you shouldn't really be that confident in. And I was no exception. Kind of when I went into this, first of all, I was like, give me a year, I'll fix the talent problem. No one knows how to do this. I got this, right? Just give me a year. Second of all, I was like, give me 3 months and I'll raise a few million dollars, which usually takes far longer than that. And then third of all, I was like, you know, within a year or two, we'll be making billions. So this is no problem at all. You know, I'm set up for success. But obviously, as I'm sure you know, interviewing founders on this podcast, the journey is far less straightforward than that. And mine was no exception.
I appreciate that humor. Tell me what would you tell yourself back then, or what would you tell a founder who's in the Google, they're still working at Google, they have the idea. What advice would you give them?
This is so funny because sometimes I think, like, you know, would I have told myself anything about the journey ahead in terms of what to or not to do if I went back? But I believe in butterfly effect, that like tiny changes lead to unintended consequences. So to be honest, I would have left myself to be a little bit just as naive as I was when I started it, because otherwise I might have been scared to do it, right? Because it all worked out. And if you don't have that naivete in the beginning, you might be scared to even try. Now, what I tell founders, because I get a lot of founders reaching out to me, or people who are thinking about starting a company, when they ask me for advice, I say, like, hey, don't let the glamour of it get in your head, because most of the time what you hear in podcasts or press stories is you usually hear from people for whom it has worked out. You rarely hear from those, and that's the majority that hasn't worked out. And two, you usually hear the good stuff and not the bad stuff. So the reality is, it's going to get hard. It's going to get really tough. And you have to have certain set of core beliefs about why you're doing it that are fundamental to who you are, if you're going to go into it and not regret it in a massive way. Have I had moments of doubts over the years? Many times. Have I always grounded myself in what I would rather be doing? Would I be any happier if I stayed at Google or just, you know, worked at another large company? And the answer is always no. But I want to make sure founders understand that, and they're not just doing it because they think it's cool. because it's cool for it has its cool moments such as this one, but most of the time it's not cool at all.
I love the honesty. Well, I'm sure you've had a lot of low moments along your journey to where you are now. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a story around one that comes to mind that would encourage anyone who's in that season right now as a founder?
So low stories, so many of them. Since the podcast is about product market fit, I'll talk about a product market fit one. So this is 2018, and we have raised a seed and a series A. So raised roughly around $13 million at that point. We've spent the majority of it. We've got like a few million dollars left in the bank, and the business is not working. It's hard to tell why the business is not working, like it happens in most cases, right? Because again, if you haven't done this, you usually think, well, if the business isn't working, I'll know why. Most of the time, you don't know why. You just know that it's not. And the way you know it's not is you're spending way more money and you're not growing nearly as fast as a venture-backed business should be growing. And we were no exception. Now, at that point, what we were doing is we had the core technology of what we had to build to achieve our mission of discovering and developing the skills that will shape the future, which was skill assessments. But the way we were monetizing this technology was through a talent marketplace. So we were a two-sided marketplace in which we would find incredible people by looking at their skills directly, and then we would try to connect them to companies that wanted to hire them. We had built a fairly successful business on this, right? Like we've raised a Series A on the back of it, but a lot of the spend was going on just pouring money into ads because we needed more people in this marketplace. And we were just at like somewhere around 1.5 million in revenue, but weren't growing fast enough, right? It was growing a little bit and then going down. And I couldn't figure out why. I was like, look, we've got an incredible opportunity here. Like we're adding value. The customers we have are happy, but like this thing is just seems to have ground to the halt. I won't name names, but a very smart person that I talked to who has run Fortune 500 companies, marketplaces, I went to see him just seeking for some advice to say like, look, I cannot tell why this business isn't scaling right now. And what he said was, look, I've seen talent marketplaces attempted before, and there seems to be a fundamental issue behind why they don't succeed in most cases. And that fundamental issue seems to be around balancing supply and demand. Because if you're trying to run a marketplace, you're trying to have a constant replenishment back into your marketplace. So for example, in Uber, you go, you take an Uber, and then you get out of that Uber, and that supply of a driver is back in the marketplace. Similarly with an Airbnb or an Instacart, right? The supply constantly goes back into the marketplace. And if you think about it in hiring marketplaces, especially full-time hiring marketplaces, the supply, if you've done your job well, disappears. So it's like every time you got into an Uber ride, you drove away with the car, or every time you got an Airbnb, you just moved into the house. That would mean the supply for them is constantly disappearing. And that makes it really difficult to create a balanced and scaling marketplace. And I had a wow moment, but that wow moment was great and horrible. Because on the one side, I was like, oh, wow, I think I know that this path of monetization of the value we're creating in the world is just doomed to fail at a venture scale. But I've made so many decisions. I've done so many things that have built on this business model that undoing those things can literally kill the company. Not undoing them is definitely going to kill the company because we're going to run out of money pretty soon. So what I had to do, the tough decision we had to make, was to sharply pivot the company to a software-based company in which we provided software for our customers to assess and hire talent as an embedded SaaS business instead of a marketplace. But that meant we had to lay off pretty much half of the team to have enough runway to even have a shot at this business. We had to fire some customers, let customers know that we cannot do this anymore. Customers that have relied on us for several years and took a chance. So it was brutal. It still constituted as one of the lowest points of the company. But since then, you know, it's only gone up and up.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. And I want to understand that decision, and maybe how long did it take you to make that decision from that meeting with that founder to deciding to lay off half the team?
It took roughly 3 weeks, and that might sound insane, but there was no other choice. Primarily because when you have like $4 million left in the bank, and you're spending $500,000 a month, every week is essentially taking one more chance out of ever making it, right? So it was one of those things where it was like, it's now or never, right? You cannot sit around on this decision. It's now or never. And every week makes it less and less likely. You're like literally racing to the ground. And you know, if you don't pull that parachute, you're 100% dead. So while we wanted to kind of take more time, be more deliberate, think about all the other outcomes, it was like, no, we're good. It's now or never. It's do or die.
It was that healthy fear of the reality of the situation helped give you clarity.
Know, what happens in majority of these cases, and this is the hardest part, it's overcoming your own ego. Because look, as a founder, what you have to do is you have to make a lot of promises, and your identity becomes intertwined with the company. And all great founders take things they say very, very seriously, and because they want others to know that they do what they said they're going to do. And sometimes what you believe to be 100% true ends up not being true. And when you uncover that it's not true, you typically are faced with two choices. One is stick your head in the ground and just kind of hope for the best. Usually you know that it's not going to come, but like hope to get lucky at some point. Or put the ego aside, show up and say I was wrong. And saying I was wrong is difficult, right? And you know, most founders have strong personalities. They hate to be wrong. They want to be right all the time. But as humans, we're more wrong than right in most situations. So I think the toughest choice was like, how do I go to investors? How do I go to my employees? How do I go to my team and say, I was wrong, but I'm willing to accept that to give the company another shot and help rescue it versus pretend that everything is going to be okay. And that's the hardest part.
And doing a retro like this conversation, it's so easy to be like, oh, well, everyone knows the right answer is to end what you were doing and pivot in the new way. But in that moment, I know there must be 100 things that are distracting you to try to make you make the wrong decision that seem right almost in the moment.
Yeah. And in retrospect, it's really easy, right? Now that we've done it and we've been successful, you're like, oh, such an obvious choice. But when you're right there and then, your mind is saying, this is so much pain and so much trouble, and most likely it's not going to work out anyways. So why do it?
Thank you for sharing that story. In the remaining time, let's unpack your product market fit journey from there, because you basically kind of had a type of product market fit with the marketplace. You realized the fundamental cap on it, and then you had to start from scratch to get to product market fit with the software. So can you tell me when you thought you hit it with the software?
Yeah. So as you said, actually, in the beginning, right, you never truly really have final product market fit. It's more in cycles, especially in venture-backed businesses, because you are essentially, unless you got just super lucky, right? Like, for example, Google, with the business model they had early on, they got very lucky. It was a business model that has still scaling, making money. In most businesses, your initial product market fit is going to get you to a certain degree of revenue, and then revenue growth is going to slow down. So if you need to keep on continuously scaling and growing at venture growth rates, you need to be constantly expanding and rethinking what markets are you selling to and what value are you delivering. And every time you rethink that, you're back from perfect product market fit to, you know, okay, we're pretty much looking for product market fit almost from scratch, or just trying to build on top of what we've got. Now, with that in mind, when we started to focus on the software component of it, the fundamental technology was there. It was adding all the bells and whistles around it that were necessary, right? You can have an incredible assessment technology, but if it's built for a marketplace and a consumer side, there's so many things that you need to do for customers to actually give it a fair shot, from applicant tracking system integrations to dashboards to analytics to invitation systems that have a lot of components to SSO and team management systems that are necessary, right? And this is why, you know, as you go on the journey of product market fit, sometimes starting with smaller companies who do not have some of these very strict requirements and things that have to work the way it needs to work is easier, because it buys you time and gives you revenue and gives you feedback to try to build everything you need to build to appeal to a larger, more established companies. The other thing that I will say, though, is unless you have a core view of where you're headed 5, 10 years from now, journey to looking for product market fit can become running in circles or optimizing for a local maximum, right? Because if you think about, you know, building incredible companies like climbing mountains, where the top of the mountain is where you're headed, it's your mission, it's your goal, and the path is your strategy and tactics to getting there. If you do not have a clear view of where you're headed in a 10-year timeline, you can end up on a hill you didn't want to end up on, right? Like, you were headed to the top of the mountain, you just optimized for a local maximum, and you ended on a hill. And guess what? Just like with mountains, with companies, if you optimized and you climbed up on a hill, coming down from that hill and changing direction is a very painful and usually a deadly process. So you have to have that clarity of vision and continuously evolve that clarity of the vision, so that every time you're making directional decisions, you can say, is this leading us to getting stuck to a local maximum, or is this getting us closer to the top of the mountain? For us, it was always discover, develop the skills that will shape the future, which means we always wanted to not just assess skills, we also wanted to build skills, which is why from the very beginning, we made decisions that were, look, if we're going to build one of the most prominent educational technology companies out there, eventually, we absolutely need assessments and we need companies to trust alternative credentials. But there are other decisions, such as how we build our IDE and the practice, how do we build the assessments, that are going to get us one step closer to eventually being able to launch the discover, develop part, like the educational part of the company. And if we hadn't done those things, as you know, earlier this year, we've launched our learning product. We could have never even gotten to that point, because we would have been stuck on a hill.
Really helpful. The last question is around, just, can you help us to find this local maximum and just pull that apart a little bit more, and how to avoid that? And it sounds like a vision is the way to do it, but I'm sure there's other things you're doing.
It's incredibly difficult. It's more of an art than a science. But I think, look, humans have not evolved in an environment in which we were like building companies and thinking about highly abstract concepts, right? We've evolved in caves and in trying to find food and trying to escape predators. So this kind of analogies to a physical world are very helpful in structuring your mindset, because otherwise you get lost in your own head. It's way easier to visualize a journey from the bottom of the mountain to the top of a very, very tall mountain where no one has gotten before, usually, if you're aiming high enough. And it's also really easy to understand that, you know, A, strategy is like, okay, how at a high level are we going to go from here to there, right? But then when you get to the tactics level, every step you make matters, because every little step can get you either stuck in some kind of a cave or getting closer to where you're going. And then on the journey to that top, there's a whole bunch of smaller peaks that could look appealing. And you can easily just be like, hey, but it's going to make us higher up, right? Because going higher is what you usually measure. And it's really easy to be tempted to climb those lower peaks and then have all of your investors say, what have you done? You got to come down from there. And the time and the resources and the money it takes to come down is just can be the end of it.
This has been amazing. Thank you so much for your time. If I'm a founder trying to reach out to you, and I know you're busy, is the best way LinkedIn or Twitter?
Mostly LinkedIn. Either one works, but I spend more time on LinkedIn when I have time. So LinkedIn would be the better one.
When you have time, keyword. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more about Zendesk for Startups, check out our website, zendesk.com/startups. Also, we're always looking to improve, so don't hesitate to email me with any feedback on how we can ask better questions, guess the target, or anything else that we can do to better help you as a founder. My email is adam.odonnell@zendesk.com.